All right, good morning, everybody. It is Wednesday morning, September 15th, 9 a.m., and we've been having a discussion for the past couple of minutes here on exactly what we want to do today. I had several options of what to do with today's lab. One option is to deal with any sort of Grignard questions that you may have, since we've been dealing with the Grignard reaction. I don't want to start moving on into the other reaction because you haven't really worked through the Grignard one yet. I want to save that and then start working through the multi-step once we get past the Grignard. The other thing that I've been using lab time for in the past semesters is that we steal a certain amount of lab time to support lecture. And I know that there are people who are in lecture who are not in lab. There may be some people who are in lab who are not in lecture. And so I don't do that very often. And I certainly don't want to cover things in lab that I don't also cover in lecture. So if I'm doing something in lab, I want to make sure that it's covered fully in lecture for those people who are taking lecture and aren't in the associated lab. So I'm careful about that. But maybe this is a good place to do some practice problems and do some things to be able to support lecture and work through some of these alkene problems that we've been doing and seeing how you guys are at attacking these problems. How does that sound for a plan this morning? Okay, I'm seeing some head nodding and some thumbs up. All right, with that in mind, we had the problems that we were doing here. Now, many of these we had started. I'm looking to see if there's anything here that we hadn't tackled. There's some 9 BBN problems. There's some problems. I think we did 16. I think we did 17. 18 with 9 BBN. Hydrogenations aren't so bad. This one's not a bad one to tackle. Two products coming out of H2SO4 with water. And maybe number 20 is a good one to deal with. Let me switch to the iPad. Get this one jotted down. So this is OChem Lab Notes, problem solving session. Switch the share over to the iPad, and then I'll draw this so you guys can see the problem that we're going to tackle. Okay, so today is a problem solving session. All right, so this is number 20 off of Alkene worksheet. And the problem is a diene. And it has H2SO4 and water. I'm going to put the water above the arrow and the H2SO4 below the arrow.
So just a question about the notation here. If it's not numbered, it's just kind of like both, all the things on the list are mixed in.
Yes.
If it's numbered as like step one, do this, and then like do some cleanup and then do step two.
Correct. And so what happens is if we do an arrow where this is H2O and H2SO4, this means all reagents present at one time. If we do something that is 1BH3THF, and then 2, we do sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water, then this is two steps. In the reaction. And so what you do is you do the first step. The first step completes, it's given a certain amount of time to complete, and then you proceed to the second step. So you're not throwing in all the reagents at the same time. And so when something, this is stepwise, it's a way of writing these consecutive steps. It means sort of like doing it this way, that you would have, this would be step number one, and then this would be step number two.
So on the left side, does the order mean anything in terms of concentration or anything?
Not in terms of concentration, but generally this is a reagent and this is a catalyst or conditions. I should say and or conditions.
So it was kind of written backwards because the hydrogen, the excess hydrogen goes back to.
Well, sometimes you'll see it. Sometimes you'll see it written the other way. So sometimes you'll see H2SO4 and then water. And the reason that they do that is because this is the proton source and this is the solvent. But in this case, what I'm trying to indicate is that I think it's easier if I put water over the top because this is your nucleophile and it signifies to you that you're doing a hydration reaction. If you saw water as a solvent, you may not think that the water is participating in the chemical reaction. You may think of it just as a solvent. And so that's why I decided to turn it around just to be more consistent. To me, I would look at this and I would see these as identical things because I'm looking at H2SO4 and I'm looking at water. And when I see that, I know that a certain reaction mechanism is taking place. But at the level that we're working, I think it's more consistent and more appropriate to put water above and H2SO4 below. I just think that makes it a little bit easier to see this chemical reaction. Okay, so that's a little bit about chemical notation. Now, this is a diene. It's a 1,3-diene. And we could specifically name it. We could give it a name. If we wanted to do it for nomenclature, we would start with the closest diene. So we would number one here, 2, 3, 4, and 5. That then becomes a substituent. And so this would be substituent 2-methyl. And then we would list the numbers of the, or we would go pent, and then we would list 1,3-diene. So 2-methylpent, 1,3-diene. The other way that that could be named, if we wanted to do it for nomenclature, is we could do it 2-methyl-1,3-pentadiene, where the 1,3 signifies the number one position, start of the alkene, and the third position, the start of the second alkene. We should also, there's a piece that's missing in here. I don't know if you see what else is missing nomenclature-wise. This is a good thing to review too, real quick, since we are responsible for nomenclature. Can you see what else is missing that I did not indicate? There's some stereochemistry missing here. In other words, there's a difference between this molecule and that molecule. These are two different molecules.
So is it trans?
It is trans, but we tend not to use the trans in a molecule like this. We tend to use E and Z. So I agree that this is the trans, but when we look at this, it would be denoted as Trans is opposite, which is ingegen. Cis is together, which is zusammen. So cis is the Z, trans is the E, and we would denote this out in front as a E molecule. And the stereochemical notation would go out in front, and it would need a locator number if there was more than one position. So if I had one more than one stereocenter, I would list it as a 3E. But since there's only one stereocenter, I don't need to note which position the E is at. So it is an E 2-methyl pent 1,3-diene, or an E 2-methyl 1,3-pentadiene. That would be the correct notation to fully name that molecule. Okay, so now that we've reviewed a bunch of things here, let's go back again to the question at hand. What do we do with this? Because this is a diene, how does that change things? What do we need to consider in this chemical reaction?
Is there a preference for one of the double bonds to react over the other?
Okay, great. So how do we start to investigate that? What do we need to do to draw here? How should we attack this?
I kind of would start backwards. I think the charge wants to be on the tertiary carbon there. And the only way the charge can be on the tertiary carbon there is with breaking the double bond on the right. And that only works because the hydrogens, like, well, yeah, that should work because there's nothing bulky in there.
Mm. Okay, so that's a great idea. So one idea is that what we're seeing here, so this is one approach. Is to see that what we want to create is the possibility of the tertiary carbocation. We would like to see the positive on what is essentially carbon number two. So we'd like to see that positive on carbon number two. And because we'd like to see that positive on number two, because that leads to a tertiary carbocation, the question is what bond do we break in order to get to that? And so that would lead to most likely breaking the first bond. And so we might consider a mechanism whereby we protonate by reaching out this way in order to generate that tertiary carbocation. So proton gets accepted there and we get that carbocation. Okay, so that's one approach. And so this is sort of a thinking backwards approach. At looking at where we need to break things. And that could work very well. Let's consider another way of looking at this though. Let's take the alkene, a second approach. Is to consider all options. And evaluate each. And so here, this approach looks like this. We take the alkene and we protonate it. And what we do is we do this four different times. So the first time we may protonate it. And this would be consistent with what we just did above. The second time, we protonate it and consider protonating on the opposite side of the double bond. But now we have the second double bond to consider. You can say this takes a little bit longer. And it's unclear where I'm going to end. Actually, let's go sequentially. So let's put that proton here and the positive charge there. And one last one. We reach out and grab that proton and we go to the opposite side. Positive charge ends up on that carbon. Okay, so these are our four options. And then we need to assess these four options and decide which of these four options is really the most stable. And so what do we need to consider in terms of the stability of these four carbocations?
Resonance?
Yes, exactly. So we should be considering resonance in each of them. And as such, I can draw the resonance in these different carbocations. There are two with resonance and two without. I'll draw that proton in there just so that we keep track of where it's located to be consistent. Okay, so there's the resonance. And now, how do I assess which of these are most stable? How do I rank these in terms of their stability of these carbocations? Which one of these carbocations? Let's list them out as A, B, C, and D. How do I rank one of these as the most stable carbocation? Or what do I need to do?
So resonance beats the other ones, so it's like A or D, really.
It is A or D. Now, how do I decide between A and D?
Would it be A because A is on the tertiary carbon as well as resonance?
Partially. Karina, I applaud the answer. That is a great insight. However, you're missing half of the argument.
Would it be that the difference is the degree of carbocation? So like in A, you have a third degree or second, and in D, you have a second or a first.
Correct. That's the other part of the argument that I'm looking for. And so it is the combination of the carbocations and the stability overall that we're looking at, not just a tertiary, but we have a tertiary and a secondary. And in D, we have a secondary and a primary. And so what happens is the two secondaries you can think of as canceling each other out. Right? And so stability-wise, the two secondaries are sort of equivalent, and we can cancel out the two secondaries. And then it's tertiary versus primary, and so the tertiary wins. And so, Karina, you were not wrong. You were absolutely correct. It's just that when I evaluate them, I like to evaluate them as a whole, because a resonance contributor doesn't exist on its own. A resonance contributor is a what we call a model for understanding stability. Resonance contributors don't exist individually. They are sort of weighted averages. Each one contributes more or less to the overall structure of the molecule, and no single resonance structure exists on its own. And so you need to sort of assess them in totality as opposed to picking out just the most stable feature and just focusing on one component, if that makes sense.
Right, that totally makes sense.
Okay, cool. And so now that we've decided that we think that A here is the most stable one, now we need to move to product. And we need to figure out how we move to product. So what do I need to consider in terms of the product or products that get formed? How do I proceed now?
Well, we check for hydride shifts first.
We can check for hydride shifts, although this is resonance stabilized. And because it is a tertiary carbocation and a secondary carbocation, it's unusual to see hydride shifts or alkyl shifts when resonance is already present. It's possible, but you already have inductively the most stable carbocation you can form, and we've assessed all of them. And also, there's no other heteroatoms like oxygen or nitrogen with lone pairs that can provide greater increased resonance. So unlikely to see a shift at this point. At this point, we want to move to looking at attack by nucleophile. And as we move to attack by the nucleophile, what we have is the incoming water molecule, which is going to bind to the carbocations. And so that's going to be our next step here. I'm going to redraw it so you guys can keep up with me. I'm going to say nucleophile. And in this case, that's our water. So we have the carbocations. And the proton that added in. And I'm doing the wrong one. We want that proton over here. We want that carbocation there. And that's in resonance. With this guy. And we have the water molecule coming in and attacking both of these carbocation positions. Those move to the next step. And the same thing over here. And then where do I go from here? What do I need to do? Are these the final products?
No, one of the hydrogen goes away, but I forget how.
Yeah. So the hydrogen goes away in one of two ways. We can invoke a water molecule, and we can take the proton by water molecule, or what I like to do is I like to use just B, where B represents a base, right? So B equals sort of a general base. And that means that this is any number of things that could be in solution that could be operating as a base. So that could even be another alkene that's being protonated by the proton. So the alkene itself could be acting as a base. It could be the conjugate of the acid It could be another water molecule. It can be any number of things that could be that general base. So you could do it either way. And that takes me down to two products. Those two products look like this. And that. So those are the two products that we were expecting when it said two products that come out of this. Now, one of these products is major and one of these products is minor. However, that is a discussion for the alkene, the diene chapter. And we do have a chapter that deals specifically with dienes. And we come back and we look at this in more detail in that diene chapter. So I'm not going to labor over which one of these is major and which one of these is minor, but I could ask you which one of these is more stable and which one of these is less stable. Do you have any idea, just looking at the alkene, which one is more stable and which one is less stable? And how do we rank alkenes? Do you remember how to rank alkenes in terms of stability? This is something you should know. Try to describe the difference between these alkenes. How would you describe the difference between them? Besides the location, what is a way of describing the alkene itself?
Maybe substituents that are attached to it?
Good, yes, substituents that are attached to it. So what we would say is we could describe the degree of substitution. So the degree of substitution in an alkene, when we look at an alkene, there is monosubstituted. Unsubstituted. Monosubstituted. For disubstituted, there are several different ways that an alkene can be disubstituted. This is disubstituted, and this is geminal. This is disubstituted and cis. This is disubstituted and trans. Then you can have tri and tetra. So all these different ways that we could look at the degree of substitution. And that what we find is that with increasing substitution, molecules become more stable thermodynamically. That what happens with an alkene is that because an alkene, when you have substituents on the alkene, those substituents pump electron density into the alkene. Pumping electron density into an alkene adds more of a pi system to it. So if we push electron density in, and these we think of as electron donating groups, what the electron donating groups do is they increase the electron density that is in the pi cloud. And by increasing that electron density in the pi cloud, what we do is we make the pi cloud bigger. And so the bigger pi cloud, when we look at that, increases the strength of the pi bond and makes the molecule more thermodynamically stable.
So there's an other argument to this, like if there's more electrons in the double bond.
Yes.
Doesn't it give it a higher local charge and make it more reactive then?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. And in essence, yes, the more substituted a double bond, the more reactive a double bond is. But reactivity and stability do not necessarily trend in the same direction. So when something is more stable. It's more stable because of when we look at, here's what we look at stability. The way that we measure stability is that we take the alkene and we hydrogenate it. We add hydrogen and we look at taking it to its fully saturated state, right? And what we can do is we can take a molecule that has the same number of carbons. And so I would take a molecule that looks like this, and then I would move that double bond to an isomer. And as I move an isomer, move the double bond and create an isomer, and I look at hydrogenating it essentially to exactly the same molecule. Now I'm adding the hydrogens in a different location, but the molecule that I end with is exactly the same. And so these two are identical. That means that they have the same energy level because those two molecules are identical when I go through and do this hydrogenation. Now I do it not with just hydrogen, but there's platinum metal that does this hydrogenation. And what I can do is I can measure the energy that is released, the change in energy. And what I find is that that change in energy is less when the double bond is more substituted, which means that the double bond is energetically more stable. There's less energy that is stored in the double bond, right? Now, it also happens that while this one is more stable, and that's because this is less energy that is released when I hydrogenate it, that means that it's more thermodynamically stable than the primary, it's also more reactive. And so we're programmed to think that stability means less reactive, but that is true in some circumstances and not true in others. The thing that lends to alkene stability is greater electron density in the pi bond. But of course, the more electron density there is in the pi bond, the more accessible that electron density becomes to other electrophiles. And so the more stable an alkene is energetically, the more reactive it is to these types of electrophilic substitution reactions, which is an interesting sort of trend and not at all expected. So what we're seeing is that while things become more stable, they are also, in a second trend here, more reactive for these types of molecules. Now that is not true for other types of molecules, where when we look at stability and we look at a sigma bond, and the more stable a molecule in terms of sigma bonds, the less reactive it is. And that's because the sigma bond is a protected type of electron density, where the electron density is between two nuclei. And so you pack all that electron density between two nuclei and you protect that electron density. And so it becomes less reactive. But alkenes, the more stable they are, the more reactive they are. It's just this opposite sort of thing that you may not have thought about. And so Travis, your initial idea here of degree of substitution or looking at the substituents attached to it was exactly correct. That's what we want to do. And the way that we would do that is we could take a look at it and we could look at the number of substituents that are on the double bond. And this is a trans disubstituted. And this one is a trisubstituted. And so the trisubstituted would be more stable. And the disubstituted less stable. Now, how that plays into which one of these becomes the major product is a much bigger discussion. But I don't want to go into that discussion right now, but this much, you should be able to do this much right now. You should be able to look at an alkene and assess which alkene is more stable by the degree of substitution of the alkene. So this is information that you should have. Okay. Any questions on what we've got here? Travis, you're
Yeah, I have a question. So back in the beginning, how would we look at this and choose an appropriate pathway for evaluation? Like going back to the two approaches that we had.
Right. Okay. So I think that what I wanted to do was I wanted to acknowledge the two approaches and while this approach is a good approach because you're thinking about carbocation, you're looking for the more stable carbocation, and that is an excellent approach in looking for the more stable carbocation. The problem with it is you might miss resonance. That could happen if you don't assess them all. So while this is a great approach because you're thinking about the carbocation and looking for the most stable carbocation, it can limit you and cause you to miss something or to miss comparisons. And so by going with a second approach of considering all options and then figuring out among those options, which is the most stable, really forces you to consider the resonance. And then from the resonance allows you to be able to see the two products that form.
This becomes massive very, very quickly.
Yes, it does. But it's a systematic approach that as long as you understand what the system is and you understand how do I assess all possibilities and you do it thoroughly and thoughtfully, then you don't miss things. And so what I'm trying to teach you is a more systematic approach of how do I tackle any problem, regardless of its size? Consider all the options, weigh the options, choose the best one, and then proceed from there. And so, yeah, you just have to consider your various options. And that's how we make discoveries, is by systematically looking at all the different possible options and then finding the right one. So that's why I wanted to show that. There's nothing, I absolutely applaud this in terms of looking at the most stable carbocation because that's what we need to do. That's what we're looking for. But the carbocation is not a singular entity. The carbocation can be a singular entity, right? As in the primary carbocation that's here and the secondary carbocation that's here without resonance. So they have no resonance. And because of that, these guys get excluded. But then that does allow us to look at these other more resonance stabilized carbocations and where the two products could come from in regards to the resonance contributors that are happening there. Note too that interestingly, by hydride shift, if I hydride shift this proton off the primary, that I arrive at A and I go from B to A by hydride shift. And, but A is going to have the lowest activation energy for its formation overall. And so even though B transforms into A, it's going to have a higher activation energy for this protonation to occur and that primary carbocation. So it's never going to go through this pathway. It's always going to go through this pathway over here. So if we rank them, the way that I sort of see this, if we rank them, this is number one, most stable. Number two, second most stable. Number three, and number four. And so what we're seeing here in terms of these guys is we're seeing a energy diagram that looks something like this, where we have the alkene, and this is the alkene and the proton. And then we are going to 1, 2, 3, and 4, where I'm coming in with energy into each one of these. And now I need to go back and sort of adjust these. To make them look about right. right? And so this is the resonance stabilized, that is the lowest energy. And then you have the resonance stabilized that is the I need to go back and look at it. Double bond there, positive charge there. And then we had the secondary without resonance. And then the primary without resonance. So those are sort of the idea here between the activation energy and the lowest activation energy. And by Hammond postulate, this is A, this was D, this one was C was the secondary, B was the primary. So this is C and B. And now you can kind of see energetically wise where that reactivity, or how that reactivity goes all the way through A and does not go into the other products because of the lowest activation energy. Does that help to visualize it and see, put everything into perspective? Kind of why we need to assess each one of those. All right, that was a good problem. Let me go back to sharing Firefox. And let's go to the second alkene problems and see what we've got in the more advanced problems. Okay, so this has some synthesis problems. And actually the first one, we are, I think, prepared to deal with. And let's see what happens with the first one. So this is the practice problems advanced, number one, practice problem advanced. And this is a synthesis one. So we've got a five-membered ring system with an oxygen in it and a alkene, and we would like to synthesize something that's got a carbonyl in it. So this is a synthesis problem. And these are more difficult. Now, you started working with Zeruba on synthesis. And in the alkenes like this, this is a great place to do this. When I do synthesis, I try to make it as much of a system as I possibly can to doing the reverse synthesis. And number one, the first thing that I like to do is I like to map the problem. And by mapping the problem, what I mean is that when I look at this molecule, one of the things that I see in it is that this five-membered ring system that's here does not change.
It's like you dropped.
Oh, I didn't drop. I'm not sharing the right thing.
Tablet dropped.
The tablet's not being shared. Thank you. Sometimes I get going and I forget that I've got multiple things here. Okay, so practice problems advanced synthesis problem. And what I've done is I've outlined that five-membered ring system. And not only do I need to outline the five-membered ring system, but I could also outline the carbon that's there. That carbon is probably the same carbon that's there. And that what appears to be missing, I could even go one more carbon and say, oh, look, I've got these carbons here. And what's missing is that this methyl needs to be removed. And what's added is this carbonyl is added. And so there's a number of different ways to do that. One way is sort of visually tracking, as I've done right now. Another way is to go through and to number them in some form. There's number 8. And number 8 needs to be removed and the carbonyl needs to be added and everything else is the same. So that's the mapping. You can do that with color. You can do that with numbering. You can do that in a number of different ways in how you want to track what's happening with the problem. And then in step number 2, I like to brainstorm. Brainstorm reactions, meaning, all right, I've got to remove a carbon. And I need to add carbonyl. What sort of reactions allow me to remove a carbon? How do I get rid of a carbon? Or let me put it this way. How do I split a molecule into two parts? How many reactions, all of the reactions that we've looked at for alkenes, how many reactions allow me to split a molecule into two parts? Most of them are like hydrations where I'm adding water. Other reactions, I'm adding HCl so I can add halogens. I've seen how to do hydroboration where I can hydroborate and then put a hydroxyl group in. I've seen free radical addition of HBr where I could put the bromine in a different position. All of those things are adding things. And yet, how many reactions have I seen where I actually split things, where I tear things apart?
Osmolysis?
Karina, yes. And Brian, yes. There was a number of people who chimed into that. Reto, I think you were in there too. Chiming in to say ozonolysis is something where I can split and remove a carbon. So in ozonolysis, what that allows me to do is to go through and do O3. That's a first step. And then there's some sort of workup step, right? And that allows me to split this molecule into two pieces. And that is actually achieving both of these goals. Because if you look at removing a carbon, this reaction can remove a carbon. And if I look at adding a carbonyl, this reaction can also add a carbonyl. And so by brainstorming, what I'm saying is this looks like ozonolysis. That's the brainstorming part. Now the question is, how do I utilize that sort of brainstorming idea of, this is going to need to be ozonolysis, and put that into a formal retrosynthesis? Okay, now retrosynthesis is a process of working backwards. You discussed this with Zaruba to some extent last semester, and Zaruba may have given you some ideas about retrosynthesis. We're going to actually go through a synthesis chapter where we do a lot of retrosynthesis and really formalize a lot of these ideas. But in essence, what we do is we use an arrow that is a double-ended arrow. And that double arrow means working backwards. And what we like to do is we like to work backwards, because if you ever think about when you were a kid, you might have done some puzzles where, you know, sometimes they have these puzzles that have mazes in them and different branches and ways that you can go, right? And so these things that have these different directions that can go, and the goal is to start over here and you got to get all the way into the center, right? And there may be different entryways that you could go in, and some of these go to dead ends and only one of them allows you to be able to get to the center. And if you start at each one of these and try to go from each one of these start positions, you can find that you'll spend an enormous amount of time trying to get to the center. However, if you start at the center and work your way back out, you can almost always find your way out. Working backwards is extremely efficient in designing something that is complicated, that can have many different starting positions. And retrosynthesis is this idea of working backwards. And it allows you to find an easier way back to the starting material, back to the starting point. Okay, and so that's the idea here behind retrosynthesis. And the way that I do retrosynthesis when I start to attack it is to ask myself questions. And it's really about asking the right questions that allows you to be able to do the retrosynthesis. You just have to know how to phrase the questions and then how to look for the answers. So the question is, right, we have this idea that ozonolysis is going to be a key thing. The question that I ask is, where do ketones come from? How do I make a ketone? What needed to be in this molecule when ozonolysis was done in order to give the ketone? And the answer to that question, well, I don't know. I can let you guys wrestle with it for a second. What do you think? Where does that ketone come from? What had to be there in order to make that ketone? From ozonolysis.
I think the double bond, right?
Yeah, the double bond needed to be there. And in fact, if we look at this molecule now and we think about the tracking and the numbering, right? This was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. The double bond needs to be between 6 and 8 in order to be able to get the carbonyl where I want it. So the double bond had to be between 6 and 8. Okay, if the double bond needs to be between 6 and 8, then I need to ask another question. And that is, where do alkenes come from? How are alkenes made? How how to make alkene between 6 and 8. So how do I make an alkene? What sort of reactions make alkenes?
Elimination.
Yeah, eliminations. Was that Josiah?
Yeah.
Nice. Eliminations. Okay, so this is done by either E1 or E2 reactions, right? And what I would say is stay away from E1s and go for E2s because these are controlled. E1s are not easily controlled. E2s are controlled. So if E2s are controlled, then I have two options of a molecule that I can go back to, right? In an E2 reaction, I have a leaving group and I pull a proton in order to make the leaving group leave in a controlled E2 reaction. So there are two possible starting points, and we will need to choose the better of the two starting points. One starting point is to have the leaving group attached on number 8 and the proton that I pull that is anti-periplanar, pull it on number 6. Or the other way is to take and to put the leaving group attached on number 6 and the proton that I'm going to pull that's anti-periplanar on number 8. Let me put in the numbers. Okay, now looking back at the starting point, can I add a leaving group to 6 from that alkene? Is there a way that I can do a chemical reaction to this alkene that will put a leaving group on number 6? Or let me ask this, is there a chemical reaction that I could take and put a leaving group on number 8 and get rid of the double bond at the same time? So can I get rid of this double bond and put a leaving group on 8 and make this? Or can I get rid of the double bond and put a leaving group on number 6? Oh, and let's do this. What is a leaving group? I'm using LG here, but what sort of thing is a leaving group? What sort of atom or halogens. Group of atoms make a good leaving group?
Halogens.
Halogens. Brian, give me a specific halogen that's a good leaving group.
Bromine, chlorine, iodine.
Okay, bromine is a great one. Let's just start with bromine. Let's get rid of LG and let's put bromine in there. Maybe this will make it easier. Okay, is there a chemical reaction that allows me to go from this alkene and put bromine on 6? Or is there a chemical reaction that allows me to go through and put bromine on 8?
So HBr, or you could do HBr in the presence of peroxide to get them to where you want them to be.
Okay, so let's take those two ideas and let's go this way. Let's take the starting material and let's explore what happens when I do HBr and where HBr goes. So the first thing that's going to happen is this is going to reach out and grab the proton. I have the possibility, I got to be careful of this oxygen. I have the possibility of that proton going in two different locations. The proton can go here, creating that carbocation, or the proton can go in that position, creating that carbocation A and B. Which one of these is more stable, A or B?
B.
Why?
Because it's tertiary, but it's also resonant. It's just further away from the oxygen. So then that would be, is it induction?
Okay, so you're going for, this is an electron withdrawing group. And by electron withdrawing group, by induction, that is going to be the farther away from the oxygen as an electron withdrawing group. And so inductively, B is going to be more stable than A.
I think so.
What about if the oxygen was to stabilize that positive charge?
Okay, so Travis is making the counter argument that maybe this is actually an electron donating group, and it is doing so through its lone pairs in order to resonate to it. And by resonance, we stabilize it. Anybody else want to contribute or weigh in?
I think it'd be A too by resonance.
Okay, Karina's going to go for A. Brian, are you being swayed one direction or the other now?
I don't know. I'll just stick to mine, but I think I'm probably wrong.
Don't be afraid to change, Brian.
That's right.
You don't need to stick with it just to stick with it.
It's a learning curve for me here.
It's a learning curve for everybody. We're all learning. That's our job here. So I appreciate having the opposing views. Thank you. Oxygen is both an electron donating group and an electron withdrawing group. Brian, you are not wrong that in B, oxygen is serving as an electron withdrawing group. In the B structure, oxygen does pull and destabilize the carbocation. And so it is an electron withdrawing group when it cannot actively resonate and donate to it. But in A, the electron withdrawing group, the inductive withdrawing ability of oxygen is superseded by its ability to donate. And it does become an electron donating group by resonance. So this is electron withdrawing by induction. And it is absolutely correct. It is not wrong. And this is why I say that I look and grade with a tremendous amount of partial credit, because I look to see what your ideas are and how they're expressed and whether they're correct or not. And Brian, your ideas are exactly correct. You are missing, however, the fact that when oxygen is in conjugation, it becomes electron donating by resonance. And so which one is more important? That's not how you spell resonance, Jason.
Resonance trumps over induction.
Exactly. Resonance is always more important. And so that makes this thing the more stable carbocation. And because of that, when the bromide comes into this, the bromide comes in and attacks this position. And the major contributor that winds up out of this is having the bromide attached in the wrong location. So HBr doesn't get it for us, right? HBr does not get the job done. But Brian, you said something else. And so the other thing that you said was to consider using HBr and peroxide. That was the other idea that you had. And if we look at the same reaction and do it with HBr and peroxide, the question is, well, does that change the reactivity? Does that change what we actually get? So let's explore the alternative, which is HBr and peroxide, and see what happens. So with HBr and peroxide, the reactivity is different. We need to consider the mechanism, which is the free radical mechanism. And so in this mechanism, what winds up happening is the first thing that adds is the bromine free radical. And as the bromine free radical adds first, this is a mechanism where the bond breaks and the electrons go back. And here we have two options as well. So we need to consider the two options. The first option is that the bromine will add let's do it this way. First option is that the bromine adds to this side, creating the radical. And the second option, right on the edge of my table, I've got a smaller table that I'm working on while I'm up here in the Bay Area. This one is where the bromine adds to this side, generating the free radical there. And we're back to this same sort of idea of A and B, and which one of these is more stable, right? And so the same factors apply. Remember that free radical stability follows carbocation stability. And so A, in this case, the oxygen is going to serve as an electron donating group, and it's going to do so through resonance. The resonance looks a little bit different, but the way in which the resonance works is that an electron is actually donated to that side. Giving us a free radical here and a pair, which is an anion, carbanion. And so we end up with what's called a Zwitter ion, but believe it or not, this is more stable. And this oxygen on this side is an electron withdrawing group by induction. And so A becomes more stable in this one. And as A comes more stable in this one, this radical then is going to be the radical that is going to pick up the proton. And the way in which the proton is picked up is the proton is picked up from another HBr, where the free radical extends out, grabs the proton, generating another bromine radical. And the major product is the one in which the bromine ends up on that carbon. So we can reverse the reactivity. Let me zoom out. We can reverse the reactivity. The normal straightforward reaction puts the bromine on carbon, what was that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, puts the carbon on, or bromine on carbon 5, whereas the free radical one puts it on number 6. Now we look back and we say, what did we want? We wanted bromine on either 6 or 8. Have I discovered any reactions that can put the bromine on 8?
Yeah, but could we use a combination of reagents, like maybe something with a bulky base that would give us the less substituted product?
I see where you're trying to go. And there are reactions that would allow us to put a bromine on 8. It may take some effort. It would not be simply through bulky base versus small base. We would have to go through and create a different alkene. We would have to create the alkene. And in fact, what we would need to do, if we wanted the bromine on 8, we'd have to create this double bond, and then we could put the bromine on 8. But the whole goal was to create this double bond in the first place. So it starts to become sort of a circular argument. To get the bromine on 8, I need to have the double bond between 8 and 6 in the first place. Getting the double bond between 8 and 6 is what I'm trying to achieve. So I can get the double bond between 8 and 6 from either one of these two, and I can get to this one over here from this initial alkene. And so this becomes the last step, and this one becomes unachievable. And now I have a full retrosynthesis. And once I have the full retrosynthesis, now I can put it and write it out in the forwards direction. How do these arguments feel? I mean, how is this?
Like a little bit wobbly every time, right? It's kind of like, yeah, you could go the other way too. there's a huge tree, a huge decision tree.
There is a huge decision tree. I absolutely acknowledge that. But this is a learned process. It's a process that we learn iteratively with lots of practice, with small problems and building, and building endurance in these problems. But these are all the things. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, number one, map the problem. Number two, brainstorm reactions that can allow you to achieve it. Number three, work on the retrosynthesis using those brainstormed reactions to help determine the path of the retrosynthesis. Then once we go through and do the retrosynthesis, then we have a bunch of decisions and questions that we ask ourselves each time. Where do ketones come from? Where do alkenes come from? How do I make an alkene between 6 and 8 versus 7 and 8, right? And so each step of the way, what we're doing is we're asking ourselves a series of questions that guide that retrosynthetic step. Then we have to go through and analyze the known reactions to decide on the proper reaction. Once the pathway is determined and the retrosynthesis is completed, now we can write it in the forwards direction. So step number four is to write the forward synthesis. So this is step number four. And I would say that there are some steps between 3 and 4 that I'm not giving you yet. There are steps between 3 and 4 that are sequencing steps that are, we'll look at a number of different types of reverse steps. So some of the reverse steps are what are called functional group transformations. Some of them are functional group interconversions. Some of them are bond disconnections. There's different techniques of types of steps that we could put names to. And then there are what are called sequencing, deciding which step needs to come first, which step needs to come second, which step needs to come third. Sometimes an order of sequencing is very important. So there are more steps that will come, but for right now, 4 steps. Map the problem, brainstorm, retrosynthesis, write it out in the forward direction. So now what we do is we take our material to write it out in the forwards direction. And we still need some decision-making to happen here, but we do know this first step is HBr and peroxide. HBr and peroxide allows me to put the halogen, and I got the double bond in there and I shouldn't, there we go. Allows me to put the halogen in that location. Now what I need to do is a next step where I need to create a double bond in that position. Now, Travis, this is going to get thrown back at you here because you've expressed the usage of reagents that would be used to do this step. And so you were thinking along these lines and I want to kind of push that a little bit. There's 2 different types of bases, small bases and bulky bases. And you had mentioned using a bulky base. What sort of base, this is an E2 reaction that I want to do here. I'm trying to remember if it was Josiah who also gave me the E2 reactions, the elimination reactions. Josiah, feel free to chime in here too, or anybody else really. What sort of base do I want to use? Do I want to use a small base?
NaOme.
Or both.
Some kind of small base, because it's sterically, because that's sterically hindered right there with
okay, NaOET, that is sodium ethoxide, is a small base. What is a bulky base? Let's just make sure that we know what a bulky base is.
Potassium terpbutoxide or tosylate?
Not tosylate, you're close. Potassium terpbutoxide, or the other one that we oftentimes... LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. That is correct. LDA looks like this. So LDA is diisopropyl amide, and the lithium is the counter ion to it, and that's what makes it a bulky base, is the fact that it has those diisopropyl groups on it. That's what LDA is. So sodium methoxide or sodium methoxide, OME, those are good small bases. And so what we need to do is we need to remember sort of our E2 reactions. We'll do an aside over here on E2, that if I have something that that I'm looking to eliminate a leaving group, a bromide, and I take and use a small base and heat versus using a large base and heat, that the small base is going to select to pull to make the more stable double bond. And so the small base is going to do the elimination, kicking this guy out, making the more stable double bond with the small base. Whereas the large base is going to see the sterics from this and is instead going to pull something that is less sterically hindered, eliminating that and producing the less substituted double bond. Right? Okay, so then the question is, do I want to use a small base or a bulky base in terms of accomplishing this mechanistic step?
Small base.
Okay, so small base, if we look at the different protons that are accessible, I have a proton there. And then I have two methyls, of which the two methyls are equivalent. The small base is going to form the more substituted double bond. And so the small base, the OET, if I choose that, would go this route. And would take me back to starting material. The large base, potassium terbutoxide, would take me that direction. And so it's, we got to watch the hard part in this. I want to acknowledge this hard part. Let me get rid of all these notations that I put in it. The hard part, and this is for everybody, don't erase the bromine, erase the bond. The hard part is you're looking at this. You don't see the protons, right? And so what you see is you see, oh, I've got protons out here. And I've got protons out here. And what you don't see, or what you forget about, is the proton that's in there, right? And so if you're looking at the protons that are out on the methyl, say, well, it doesn't matter. I could use small base or bulky base. It's the same thing. And so it doesn't matter which base I use. I could just use any base, except for the red proton. The red proton is going to be selected by the small base. And that takes you back to starting material. And so the lesson here is draw the protons. Draw them all. Make sure that you actually get them down to consider them so that you can consider what you need to do between a bulky base or a small base. And that if you don't draw them, you run the risk of missing them. And so what it turns out is that these will all be in the notes in the video. But it turns out that what we need to do here is we need to do a bulky base. We need to use potassium tert-butoxide. And that is usually done in a solvent of tertiary butanol. No, that is not what I wanted to do. That is done in tertiary butanol with some heat in order to accomplish the E2. And then there's one more step that we need to do. So So what's the last step that needs to go here? We need to get down to this product.
The ozonolysis from the beginning.
Yes. And this is the ozonolysis step. So this is one ozonolysis, but then I need to choose a workup. Do I want an oxidative or a reductive workup? See all these choices every time. It's just like, it's brutal. It's not like I can ever just write down and just say, ozonolysis, done, out of here. It's like everything I need to write down. There's like all these choices.
Can we see the ending product that we're supposed to get to again?
Let's see. The ending, this is the ending product you're supposed to get to. This is done.
Okay. And that would be, that'd be an oxidative process. So we'd work it up with H2O2 NaOH and H3O plus.
Yeah, that'll absolutely do it. Let me ask if there's any other ideas. Brian is absolutely correct. There's nothing wrong with what Brian said. Are there any
dimethyl sulfide?
What's that?
Dimethyl sulfide.
Dimethyl sulfide is a reductive workup. Will that give us the same thing?
We'd have ACOH and H2O2.
You could do that as well. So another idea here is that we could do ACOH, acetic acid, and hydrogen peroxide, and we could do it in one step. Those are both oxidative. Reto, you gave me a reductive. You gave me dimethyl sulfide. And my question is, will dimethyl sulfide work here?
Yeah, I think so. Like, what else is it going to do?
That's right. It won't do anything else. And so dimethyl sulfide will absolutely work here. And so would zinc and water. And in fact, we could use oxidative or reductive here, and it makes no difference. Travis is throwing his hands up. But why are you asking? Why are you making me go through this? Because you need to consider it. Because sometimes it does make a difference. And if you don't consider it, then you haven't considered all the options. And so I'm trying to help you with the decision-making and thinking through all these steps. And that unless we exercise those connections, let me show you why it makes a difference and why it doesn't make a difference. So let me go ahead and eliminate this and just leave the one that Brian gave us to begin with, because that was perfectly good. Let me show you what happens. Here's what happens. When we go to do the ozonolysis creates two parts. And if I do an oxidative workup, the oxidative workup, regardless of which of the two oxidative steps I do, the oxidative workup, gives the carbonyl here. And on this side, it gives formic acid. If I do one ozonolysis and two reductive workup, then what it does is it gives the same molecule for the large carbon portion, but it gives formaldehyde. So this is formic acid. And this is formaldehyde. But the other part is the same regardless, because it's disubstituted. And because it's disubstituted, I end up with just the carbonyl. There's no proton on it. And because there's no proton on it, I get the same thing regardless. Now, which would I choose to do, oxidative or reductive? I said, it doesn't matter. It only matters in terms of which one of these two molecules, formic acid or formaldehyde, is easier to get rid of. And the answer is, it depends on your workup. This is a gas. And as a gas, this thing can just blow off with a little bit of heat, and it's easy to get rid of. Formic acid, this is a liquid. And so if I'm doing some sort of aqueous extraction, then that formic acid is going to be highly water soluble, and I could get rid of it with an aqueous extraction. And so it depends upon what workup I really want to do with this. Maybe all I want to do is after ozonolysis, I just want to rotovap it and get the formaldehyde off by rotovapping it. Or maybe I'm going to do an acid-base extraction to get rid of my formic acid after this step. And if I have a rotovap handy, I'll go for this one. If I don't, then I'll go for the aqueous extraction. If I have the reagents to do this reductive, it's pretty easy. But what I'm trying to say is it doesn't matter for this one. And that for some of them, it does. And we should always consider and think about which one we want to do and what are the ramifications of doing both. And if you sit down and you draw out your options, by drawing out your options, it makes it clear which one you can choose. When we sit and we look at it and we try to guess, that doesn't go so well for us. Always drawing out your options as much time as it takes. Here's my story on this, right? If I am interviewing accountants and I have several job applicants come in and I ask them to add up three numbers or five numbers, and I give them the five numbers that I want them to add up. And four of those accountants can do it in their head and they get the right answer. And the fifth accountant comes into my office and I ask him to add up the five numbers. And the accountant reaches for pen and paper and writes them all down and then gives me the right answer. It took that accountant longer to do it, but I'm going to hire the guy who wrote it down. And the reason is because the guy who wrote it down is not going to take shortcuts and is going to get the right answer more often than somebody who's going to try and do it in their head. That's the accountant that I'm going to hire.
Wouldn't you want the accountant that asks you what it adds up to?
I want the accountant that's going to sit there and write it down and going to get it right more often. Who's going to look at it and double check his work or her work. That's what I want. I want somebody who's going to sit down and write it down and is going to make less mistakes because they've written it down. So that's my lesson here, is write the damn thing down. Spend the time. The time is not wasted. The time is getting you to the right place. The time is, it needs to be spent in order to be able to do this correctly.
So do you leave the dead ends there as well, or you just kind of eliminate the dead ends? Like how do you mark that you've already kind of like explored this pathway and it didn't lead anywhere, or how far down the rabbit hole you went this way or that?
That's personal preference in how you keep track of notations and how you're doing it. I mean, you can see what I'm doing. I'm trying to model best practices that right here, as we went down, we did ozonolysis, came back to two options. I eliminated an option. I chose a pathway, right? And so I'm not afraid to write these down and to cross them off. Beautiful work that is just perfect with no options written in it is beautiful, but that's not work. That's something that has been revised and edited. And I'm more interested in demonstrating a process where I do consider and then eliminate options. And that's how I track it.
Somebody comes along later, they might wonder if you have considered this option, right? So if you haven't written it down, then you can't tell.
That's true. I don't oftentimes look for that as much as I do look for the solid reasoning. And so if you give me an edited version and it's on a test or something and it's just perfect and there's none of these types of considerations, I don't think that you were cheating. And I don't think that you didn't consider the option, although it crosses my mind. But leaving it there really clearly shows your work and shows how you're considering. I mean, notice what I've modeled here. I've modeled writing down my questions. I've modeled taking and drawing my products. I've modeled making choices and the reasons that I'm making those choices, right? And so each one of those things I'm trying to model as best practices. That dinged in my ear really loud. My daughter's texting me, which is not a good time to text her back. So anyway, this is how I'm modeling tracking, is by putting in the options, crossing things off, as you get to them and trying to eliminate them as much as possible. Okay. Let's go back and consider. Let's see. Any other questions on that? I'm dumping out of that and going back thinking about going back to Firefox and the next problem here, which is a synthesis scheme. And I want to look at, we could probably do number two. We haven't done hydrogenation yet, so I'm going to hold on number three. We could do number two and see how that works. We've got another sort of, we didn't take a break today, I'm noting. We could go a little bit further, or we could take a little bit longer break. How are you guys doing? Or any questions on the last thing that we were on?
I had a question on when we were doing step four, the forward direction. When we were, why would the small base select that red hydrogen that you drew? Is it because it's on the most substituted position?
Yes. So the question that you're asking is in the E2 reaction.
Yes.
And in the E2 reaction, when I consider the protons and I have the bromide that is here and the digeminal methyls, let's consider that I have the protons that are out here and the proton that is in here. And we can call these protons, we'll call this one HA and these HB. And we can even denote them by color, that there's my HA and HBs are clearly different. And there is one other methyl that has three other HBs on it as well. In these reactions, if I take and I choose a small base, the small base can make both of these products. So the small base can pull HA to eliminate the bromine. And the small base can also pull HB to create that product. And so I can make both these products. The answer to this question has to do with the stability of each of them. So this one is tetrasubstituted. And this one is disubstituted and it's geminal. So stability wise, when I look at an energy diagram, if I were to take these and place these on an energy diagram, what I would see is that that's my starting material. I have a couple of different transition states and a couple of different products in terms of their stability. The tetrasubstituted is the most stable. And the disubstituted geminal is less stable. In terms of being able to access these and get to these protons, what we find is that this guy here, HA, is a little harder to get to. It has some sterics around it. And because of the sterics around it, what we find is that it's got a transition state. That's not the right proton. and that didn't work. Try again. Oh, I know what I want to do. That's really what I want to do. So there's really the transition state. And this one goes like that. And so in pulling these protons in order to do this, what we find is that it has a little bit more activation energy for the formation of this guy, but with a small base, these reactions are fairly reversible. And this is what's called a thermodynamic product. As a thermodynamic product, that product has a higher activation energy, but is lower in energy overall. And because these things are reversible, that the longer it runs and the more energy that's in the system, it selects for the thermodynamic product. And generally what we do is we choose the thermodynamic product. This one is called the kinetic product. And so with a small base, something like sodium ethoxide, the energy difference between these activation energies, between these transition states, is not super great. And because the activation energy here is fairly small, it usually winds up going for the thermodynamic product. Now, when you change that and you change this from sodium ethoxide, and we go and we look at what happens with potassium tert-butoxide, the picture changes. So with potassium tert-butoxide, it looks more like this. Here's the bromide. Here's HB and HA. Now what happens is potassium tert-butoxide is really bulky. So as that comes in, it gets all of the sterics around HA. And as it tries to pull the two protons, HA and HB, it has a much easier access to HB than it does to HA. And it results in a higher yield of pulling the least steric proton, which is HB. And energetically, if I compare it and I take this diagram, what changes is this. So now with potassium tert-butoxide, the proton that is more sterically hindered winds up lifting this like this, and it makes a bigger energy gap. And the energy gap becomes so great that it puts the thermodynamic product out of reach. I'm going to exaggerate it a little bit. And so now this energy difference between these is really large. And that has to do with the fact that we've switched to a bulky base and the sterics associated with that trying to get to pulling HA versus HB.
That's much more clear. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Karina, thank you for the question, because that was a really critical concept from the E1, E2, SN1, SN2 chapter, and the differences between bulky base and small base, and why the bulky base really starts to go for the kinetic product as opposed to the thermodynamic product. And it really has to do with the sterics of that base and how that sterics of that base plays into, because what you need to remember is that these energy diagrams are not just about the reactant or the product. They're about all the reactants, the base included. And so when you throw this bulky base into this, it changes the structure of this transition state, right? And so the transition state now, it's really about that transition state. If we take that, the other picture that I could draw here, which is really nice, is that I could draw this picture that has the bulky base trying to pull this proton. And it is the dotted lines. And the partial minus that results there. And the partial minus that is there. And that is the transition state versus the transition state that is down here, where we're trying to pull this proton. And so this becomes the dotted line. The partial minus, the dotted line. And then the bromide is being kicked out. That's the partial minus there. And the formation of that double bond. And it's those sterics differences where this guy is really pushing the sterics and creating a larger energy difference. That makes it even more clear. And the small base just doesn't feel the sterics the same. And so the energy difference between these two becomes very small. And that's where the difference comes in. All right. Anything else? Or is that bringing up any other questions as we go down the rabbit hole? I think that's a really outstanding set of questions, though, and a good discussion. Okay, I'm thinking that this might be a good spot to cut it. Rather than trying to do that other thing in 15 minutes, I'm not going to do it justice if I try and do that next problem in 15 minutes. I think we take a longer break here, and we come back at 11:15, and we start lecture, and we look at some more of the reactions, some more of the alkene reactions, and we add to our toolkit of different alkene reactions. Does that sound like a plan? All right, since we didn't get a break, let's go take a longer break now. Get up and move around a bit. And hey, you guys are invested in it. You're sticking with me, and I'm super proud of all of you. And this was a great discussion. I feel like you guys brought a lot to this class, and I feel like you're contributing and taking it in a direction that suits you. And I think that's outstanding. That's what I want. So you guys are doing a great job. Okay, keep with it, and I'll see you back at 11:15. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.